The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
Good news, bad news. All those spam and text calls you've been getting lately? Well, that's a result of your information having been sold by third-party data brokerages, or it's been stolen and sold to nefarious people. Ticketmaster recently had a data breach where 560 million users' information was stolen and sold on the dark web. This included their names, physical addresses, email addresses, credit card information, and much more. Best case scenario, this just ends with more annoying phone calls and text messages. Worst case, it's going to end in fraud and you're really going to be in the hurt locker. That's why I've been using a service called Aurora for over a year now. I've talked about it on the podcast before, but not only do they monitor the dark web and the internet for my information in case it is involved in a breach, they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. When I signed up, they identified over 60 that had my information and went right to work removing me from these data brokerages. Now, yep, you could do this yourself, but each one of these data brokerages has its own policies and procedures, and I have no idea how you would even start trying to remove yourself from these services, let alone how much time that would take. But Aurora does that, as well as they offer a whole suite of tools to keep you safe, including a VPN, antivirus, password management, parental controls, and identity theft insurance. You get this all in one app, one place, so it's super simple. And you can do this with a 14-day risk-free trial. Super simple. And if you don't like it, you just cancel anytime. It's not complicated. At a minimum, you can take a look and see what information of yours is out there lurking on the web right now. Use the link down below in the description or go to aurora.com/afterburn and you get 14 days risk-free, cancel anytime, super easy, and take the first step in protecting yourself out there on the interwebs. That's the good news, by the way.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
The most unique was Sit Alert. And so you had the 5-minute alert. They called it Zulu Alert. And you had four jets on alert. And so the horn would go off. You'd slide down the fireman pole. You'd run to the jet. And in like a minute and a half, you would get the Eagle. And you're in full burner screaming down the runway. You took off on runway 24, and then you would do the Immelmann departure to then go eastbound, because that's where your next threat was. So it was the Immelmann departures. And one of our best missions was just to take off and not have any airspace. And you would squawk 033. You would come up on some TAD and talk to one of the German controllers. Yeah, this is Strawbasket. This is Speed Apple. And you would just tell them, hey, I got two Eagles, an hour playtime. Let's run intercepts. And as long as you stayed below 10,000 feet and you ran on other military aircraft, knock yourself out. Started doing the air supremacy, air dominance thing. I mean, the Iraqis didn't fly after day three. They started burying their airplanes kind of deal. So after that, I'm just going to rage around your country and go wherever I want and do whatever I want. A very different concept of, instead of being totally defensive, you're like, dude, I'm going to bring it. And I can, you know, when you're flying the old Eagle, the old, like the A model Eagle, and your computer is, I don't know, like a slide rule, you couldn't do things, right? It was very, very simple. And when you got to the C model and you got to the Raptor, all of a sudden you had all this SA. And so we would have, as instructors, people get into big conversations like, all right, we're going to start off turning everything like halfway off. And so they don't have SA, and they learn the blocking and tackling, because if they don't learn the blocking and tackling, they're just going to be rubes. To call it the trip to no slack island, right? There's no slack here. You'd walk in the squadron. It was the barnyard is what they called it. And the first thing you see is on the chalkboard the number to the Betty Ford Clinic, in case you got problems. And the next number you see is the number to the Greyhound bus line, in case you need to get a ride out of here.
What's up? Hope everyone is doing well. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching if you're over on YouTube. My guest today is Colonel William Biff Moff. He started his career flying the Mighty Eagle and then wrapped it up flying the F-22. Had an enjoyable conversation with him. I think you're really going to like it.
As always, thanks to my Patreon supporters for making the podcast happen. If you're interested in supporting the podcast, getting access to There I Was stories, as well as some early access to content, you can swing over to Patreon. I got a link to that down below, as well as on my website, theafterburnpodcast.com. Those There I Was stories are also available to Apple Podcast subscribers, and now they are available to Spotify Podcast subscribers. If you're interested in that, great. It helps the podcast out. But at a minimum, everyone who has gone over to Spotify and iTunes, left a rating or review, that helps the podcast get shown to more people, and I greatly appreciate you taking the time. The same applies over on YouTube. So as always, thank you to those who have supported the podcast. I'm truly grateful. Any reviews you leave, I read each and every one of those. So thank you for taking the time to do that. With all that being said, let's jump into the podcast with Biff.
Seat tight. Altimeter 0 eyes. We're clear for takeoff. Clear for the airspace.
Fire projector.
My bad ramp curveballs at 354.
Sir, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Happy to have you on here. Looking forward to hearing a few stories and a little about your career.
Excellent. Happy to be here.
Well, before we get rolling in, I always ask everyone for like the elevator pitch of like who they are and what they're doing and how they got there. Can you kind of give me just a little bit of background on you and your surmise, your Air Force career, because we're going to dig into it and then what you're doing today?
Okay, so my name's William Mott, and I've been called Biff since I was a little kid, and it worked out fine for flying as a call sign. My dad was a soldier, and so I was all set to go into the Army, and then all of a sudden got the itch to go fly, and went to the academy, and was fortunate enough to get selected to fly the F-15, starting back in the Cold War. I flew the F-15C. I did that for my entire career, did weapon school, all that kind of stuff, and then finally I got to fly the Raptor. I flew the Raptor as the group commander at Tyndall, and that turned out to be a great culmination to the flying career. And after the Air Force, I got into program management. I did that for a little bit, and then I got into sales. And so now I am part of the dark side, as they call it, doing business development. And that's what I've been doing for like the last 10 years.
Yeah, it's a busy business there. I'm curious, we'll jump forward here, but going from the Raptor or going from the Eagle to the Raptor, what was that like and what year was that?
That was 2007. So I'm coming off the staff. I picked up for group command and I go to Tyndall Air Force Base, which is the FTU, the training units for it, for at the time, the Eagle, the Raptor, and then the Air Battle Managers. And so what's interesting about that is you, as the commander, can fly everything you own. So I'm like, all right. So I take the senior officer course for the Raptor, and it was super exciting and super fun because it's a great airplane, but it's only four rides. It's like how to take off and land and not hurt yourself in it.
Right.
And it just was like the big teaser, right? So I do that. I then get to Tyndall, move in, do all that kind of thing, and I go fly the Eagle because I want to go see my squadrons, right? So I go fly the Eagle, and it's like, oh, I'm back. I'm back with the lady I started with. Everything was right. The stick's in the center, you know. And I had two sorties in the Eagle where it just felt so good. And the Raptor now was feeling kind of weird. And my my commander, Brigadier General Walters at the time, Magoo, was like, all right, cut that crap out. No more flying the Eagle until you're an instructor pilot again in the Raptor. And I'm like, okay, sir, I can see your point. So I spent 60 days, do the full, you know, syllabus, get checked out in the Raptor, and I'm okay. I mean, it's new, but I'm okay. And then I go, hey, it's time. I can go fly the Eagle again. And I get in the Eagle and I'm like, what the hell is this? It was like a totally different airplane. I'm like, it's not climbing out at 450. I can't go supersonic just without even thinking about it. This is awful. How do these guys do it? And you realize how quickly your brain trains you to what you're most current in. And it was at that point, from that point on, when I went back to the Eagle, I had to like really get serious about, all right, don't screw this up. Make sure everything works. And I mean, like I went to an Alaska flag and I got to fly the Raptor and that, and I'm flying with the Eagles. We're doing the mixed force stuff. And those guys are working their butts off to kill somebody and not be killed. And you're just like, geez, guys, oh my gosh, oh, this is terrible. I feel so sorry for you. You know, kill that guy, kill that guy. It was just really kind of a fun experience. But yeah, the Raptor, it did everything as an Eagle driver you wanted it to do. It was just really cool.
This episode is sponsored by Aura. How much of your life is exposed in the digital realm? I recently started using Aura, and within a matter of minutes, Aura identified over 60 data brokerages that had my personal and private information. And the best thing is they automatically started opting me out of each of those data brokerages to help protect my privacy. Aura offers comprehensive identity theft protection. With Aura, I can rest easy knowing that my personal information is being monitored 24/7. Any unauthorized use or suspicious activity, and I get notified immediately so I can start taking action. Many of you know I travel routinely throughout the month, maybe 5 or 6 countries on average. Aura also offers a VPN to help protect me when I'm using public Wi-Fi networks or those hotel Wi-Fi networks, as well as antivirus protection to keep my devices safe. I love that I can manage all my passwords with Aura's password manager, which generates complex and unique passwords. I don't have to worry about remembering the complex passwords, nor do I have to use the same password for each site. Overall, Aura has helped protect my online and digital life. Aura's identity theft protection, VPN, password manager, and credit score monitoring help keep me safe. And Aura does this all from a web-based as well as an app-based platform. For 2 weeks free, risk-free, go to aura.com/afterburn. That's aura.com/afterburn, or click the link down below in the description and start protecting your online identity today.
The only experience I had with it was at a checker flag down at Tyndall. We're doing missile shoots, and then we would do large force exercise in the afternoon or the morning. But going back and then watching the Raptors tape, you know, after seeing what I saw on my radar and then seeing what they saw, I was like, well, this is not even fair. Now I know what you guys are just doing, just out there just slaying, shooting. And I'm just like, I hope I get a radar contact, and oh, I'm just getting jammed, my face jammed off. This really sucks. What? Yeah. Oh, did the Eagle at that time have an ace of radar, or is it still a Mexican? So, I mean, you're really going from the Nokia phone to the iPhone.
It was just amazing of how little SA you had in an Eagle versus the Raptor, and how much you had to worry about getting spiked and all that kind of stuff. You know, it was just really interesting. We were doing the first B coursers going through. And the whole command was freaking out. You know, these guys are getting this 9G aircraft at single seat, blah, blah, blah. They had a very long course. They went to Luke and did Viper stuff just to, you know, do all the stuff that's hard. And it was interesting to see that these 8 guys, I think they turned into Superman. I mean, I swear they were, like, went right to mission commander because they had so much SA. It was like one of my things that I never got to do was to track them down. You know, I see the old pictures from graduation and stuff like that, but I think I ran into one of them, and I think he's in the reserves now or something like that. But I think we really underestimate how quickly this generation can take on these big aircraft. You know what I mean? Like right now in UPT, people are worried about whether they can handle all the T-38 nuances and stuff like that. And yet these are the students that are playing DCS, and they know what a single circle fight is and a two circle fight. And they've got hours and hours in virtual reality simulators. It's like, you know, I think it's just different, you know, because in my time, it was a different experience. You went from, you know, playing with Tonka trucks to flying fighters. And I think this generation, because they got their iPhones, there's so much, it doesn't shock them as much. And I've actually talked to people like Lieutenant Colonels and stuff like that who deal with training, and they don't want to give the students as much as I think they should. And I go back to my experience in the Raptor. We were like, oh, no, don't let them go supersonic. Hold back on the reins. And yet, the kids did okay. It's interesting. What does that tell you? You know what I mean?
That is an interesting perspective. We talked about it with a few other guests on the podcast. And I think this is the way it's always been, or this is the way I did it. But as technology evolves, like the planes, while they are still complex and can reach out and bite you if you don't respect it and know the systems, et cetera, the planes, to a certain degree, like a Viper, I would probably say is easier to fly than an F-4. You know, there's the way it is mech, the way it is designed. The ergonomics are there a little better, the Raptor, the F-35. And so I had a buddy who was a strike eagle, Bubba, then went to the F-35, teaching the B course. And his analogy was he would assume that most wingmen coming out of the F-35 now have that situational awareness that a four-ship F-16 flight lead would have, or a four-ship F-15 flight lead would have. They give that wingman, hey, you now own this lane over here, where that used to be a four-ship of Vipers, and that flight lead is managing just because of the technology, the way, you know, what that plane can do and see. Like you said, these kids have now have grown up used to being on tablets, used to playing DCS. Yeah, it's just different. It's a different problem set.
So, you know, when you're flying the old Eagle, the old, like the A model Eagle, and your computer is, I don't know, like a slide rule, you couldn't do things, right? It was very, very simple. And when you got to the C model and you got to the Raptor, all of a sudden you had all this SA. And so we would have, as instructors, people get into big conversations like, all right, we're going to start off turning everything like halfway off. And so they don't have SA and they learn the blocking and tackling, because if they don't learn the blocking and tackling, they're just going to be rubes. And it was like, wait a minute, they got all this stuff. Shouldn't we be teaching them how to use all this stuff? No. You need to turn half that stuff off. And it was very spirited, you know, technology questions. And I don't remember what side of it I came down on, but I know that when I got towards the Raptor, I started realizing, okay, this is dumb. You don't train with half your stuff. And yet, right. You know, it was, and even we would get into, like, this happened in the 80s when the 9 Lima came along. All of a sudden, this fly BFM to the control zone, Papa Wes, why am I doing that? I'm just going to point and shoot at the guy. You can't do that. You're not in the control zone. It's like, oh, here we go.
Yeah.
It's so, I don't know. I have a feeling if you were to talk to people now, you know, the young people, the captains and majors and all that, how does the training flow? It's different than what it was when I was a captain. Totally different approach, because the technology is so immersive. I remember I had to go do a safety board, and they let me fly the T-38. So I'm up there riding in the back seat going, this thing's a dinosaur. You have got to be kidding me. And I knew the guy in the front seat. He was one of my lieutenant colonels. And so he's like, okay, sir, I'll let you fly the whole thing, but I'm not going to let you land it. And I'm like, why? And he goes, I'll show you. And so I take it to the flare. He lands it. And it's like, holy crap. Remember the stubby little wings, and you're just doing this with the funky landing gear? And I'm like, okay, good call. I don't want to be that guy. And yet I then roll into that world of, we don't have adversaries for the Raptor, so we're going to dual qual our Raptor pilots in the T-38. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, are you guys nuts? And they're like, oh no, so we're cool. We're good. You're just a dinosaur. But I don't know where I'm going with that story, but it just was interesting to see the old technology. The more you saw the new.
I think it's just a tough thing for people to break that mold. And we've seen it with how pilot training is changing. And I think there's some good things, there's some bad things with it. But my son, he has a PlayStation, and he has like Ace Combat, some like fighter jet game. It's got VR goggles. I'll be honest, you throw it on, and this is, you know, rudimentary PlayStation, but if you actually had a simulator that was dedicated to it, probably some of the stuff that Red 6 is doing with augmented reality.
Yep, freak.
Like, I really can see the potential in like leveraging technology to make training more effective and, you know, beneficial. And utilizing it appropriately is like the key piece here, not cutting, I mean, taking shortcuts. But I mean, man, it is a game changer when you can go out there and actually fight the way that the plane is designed to fight. You can turn on all the technology, you're not turning things off, try to make it tough like it used to be. And I always think too, you know, again, I had Admiral Fox on the podcast, Captain Sterling Gillum's another Navy guy. These love the Navy brethren. I always find it funny though, but like, they all know the number of traps they have, and rightfully so.
Oh wow!
Like, I wouldn't want to land on a boat. I've said that, and I stand by that. But hearing the discussion, like, if you had the technology to make it easier to land on a boat, and now while you need to know how to do it. And you could spend, if you had to spend 10 sorties to figure out how to land on a boat, but now the technology allowed you to spend 5, and then you can use that technology to help you. You can spend the other 5 sorties going out there learning how to employ your machine to
That's
kill
heresy.
Things.
You're just crazy, man.
It's insanity. But I mean,
so one of my good friends is Spock Bynum, and Admiral Bynum flew with us in at Langley when we were doing Southern Watch or something like that after the Gulf War. But Spock's a Super Hornet guy, and all this experience. And you talk to him about coming aboard ship. You know, he got a bunch of us out on the Independence to watch the thing land. But, you know, they go to the T-45 and then go fly off some aircraft carrier in the Gulf, and they get their training that way. And there you go. Now you're ready to go to the RAG. They're actually thinking about not landing the T-45 because that training doesn't apply to the technology of the F-35 and the F-18 Super Hornet coming aboard. So, talk about a major leap for the Navy to go, wait a minute, we're not going to go to the boat anymore in training until we get to our major weapon system. That's heresy. But no, that's reality because technology is changing. You know, Spock would talk about coming aboard with no HUD. He goes, that's a sporty little game. And, you know, he did that for most of his time. And he says, nowadays, you just like the Raptor or the Viper, you put the thing on the thing and you fly the thing at the right number of pitch ladder degrees and boom, you're there. So anyway, you're right. Technology changes and it's been fun. At my current job, I sell flight simulators and I do the VR goggle stuff and all that. So really into what's going on at Pilot Training Next and how that's all training. And it is fun to watch all the technology and be really cool about it, but then go, I'm old school. I think you just got to fly your butt off. And they're like, no. Shh, you don't understand. And anyway, it's fun in the current role I have to try to look back and see how things are changing. You know, now guys are getting their wings after T6, right?
They are, yeah. And that's the part where I'm not hitting the I believe button on that just yet because I'm skeptical of like, why are we doing that after T6s? Now you see they're doing T1s and simulators only, I think. Is it Redbird that is doing? You guys are doing it. Okay. So we need to talk about this, cause I'm curious to, you know, be smarter about it, but that piece with, I think the argument from, you know, probably you, me, got old hats, if you will, and I say that loosely, but you can't replace airmanship by just cutting out flight hours and doing simulators.
No.
But I do think, you know, seeing some of these simulators and the technology that exists today, if you went through instrument training, contact training, if it's a weather day, you're able to go over to the simulator and train. It's not a syllabus deviation. For those who don't know, it's like if you did something like that back in the day, the two stars getting briefed on why Lieutenant so-and-so got a extra sim that wasn't in the syllabus. But if you leverage that technology to make better pilots, in the end, you're going to, one, make better pilots, I think, and two, you're probably going to save some money down the road when they don't hook their instrument ride because they got to practice in an environment that was on the ground, relatively cheap and relatively immersive. So curious. So can you talk to about the T1 training and how, or is that you guys, or can you talk about the simulators and kind of what's going on?
Yeah, I work for SAIC and that, you know, we're one of the giant defense contractors and that's our little business area that we're working on. Air Force gets a bill for the T1. Hey, you got to update it. You got to make it new. And the Air Force is like, oh my gosh, I don't have money for that. I want to put money into F-35s or some sort of more combat situations. So they said, let's try to make what we were doing in the T1, the T1 simulator. So knock yourself out. So you put the goggles on and it's mixed reality. So you can still see your hands. You can still read your lineup card. And yet everything outside the windows is virtual. So you can see your co-pilot and do your thing with him. And the thing is 3 degrees of motion. So when you shut down one of the engines, you get the yaw and it wiggles when you hit the ground and all that. And it's gone through like the prototyping phase. They put some students through it and they're like, I guess this kind of works. And the trick is when these guys in the heavies go through the T1, their next aircraft is the C-130. C-130 is going to be like 16 simulator rides and 2 sorties and that's it. So it fits really, really well. I don't see this replacing, you know, fighter stuff because we've got to go upside down and all that. It's really a pain. But I think what you're seeing is the recognition that simulation can better prepare you when you actually do get in the jet. You're not just, holy cow, how do I program the radio? That was the thing back in the Eagle. We had half quick and you had to like use both arms and do this kind of garbage. But I think it's changing. And one of the analogies that I'll make to the simulation world right now is that when I was at UPT or a lieutenant trying to learn to fly the Eagle, chair flying is what you did. You know, today, tomorrow you're doing ACM and you would sit there and strap on your in-flight guide and your checklist and sit in the chair and imagine it all. And that's how you got ready for it. I remember doing that for flight lead upgrade because they're like, all right, look, you've been on the wing and now you got to take a formation to the airspace. Have you thought about that in a long time? Nope. I don't even know what the departure is. And, right. and so you would chair fly dumb stuff like that. So I really think what you're seeing now is this lightweight simulator stuff becoming chair flying, and it's going to gain acceptance as it grows. And I also think that eventually the technology is going to really affect what people do. Like, can you make a better red flag? Can you make a virtual flag? I'll bet you can, you know, I bet you it's coming. And it has to happen and it's coming. I think people have had to figure out the smart way to do it. So you don't have this is terrible. We're losing all of our airmanship. because it's a reality. But like, look at it this way. When I went to Bitburg, we had a simulator. It was a full motion. I swear it was made by Goodyear, but it was probably made by Boeing or whatever. But they had like a Goodyear sticker on it. And you could only do instruments in that. That's all you could do. You could fly and do instruments. There was no visuals. We could run a radar intercept on a single target. And so everything I learned at Bitburg was in the aircraft. There was nothing in the simulator. And you know, even weapons school. In the early 90s and the 2000s, when I was the commander there's no simulator. Do it. Go fly. And so that's why I think it's there's resistance in the community to go, wait a minute. But it is changing. It has to change.
Yeah, we're super resistant to change. Just looking at like our personnel system, like, yeah, it's super painful to make any of those changes. But on that note, it's like we're talking about if you went out and did a seed sortie or a DCA sortie in the Viper, you get maybe one vol, maybe a vol and a half on a training sortie, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, depending on what kind of adversary air you can put up, you know, you might only have two red air and they're regenning constantly trying to generate a picture. But in the simulator, you can go get two full looks, two vols, so 25-minute periods. And the sim instructors can throw low guys, high fast flyers, walls at you. And that's really where you can start practicing, you know, target tactical flow and how you're going to do that. And when you go out there, so as simulators get better, elegance better and better. But, you know, you gotta get some air on the range.
Balls. It's like going to the driving range. Great, good job. Driving range feels good. It's different when you get on the course and, you know, you got to get on the green. You got to, you know, make par. It's different. So they got to find the balance between doing that. I mean, you know, at the academy, they got like 50 simulators. It's like, what? 50? Yeah, they're on the airfield. They're in the academic thing. And it was part of my reality. But when the guys get to UPT, they are so much more full of airmanship than what I did. I was like, really? Yeah, I was impressed by that.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, let's jump back. So obviously Air Force Academy, and then you go to pilot training, and then mm-hmm. to the Eagle. Bitburg is your first assignment in the Eagle, mm-hmm. is that right? What was that like? I mean, again, you're flying up initial and the Soviets were right across the way there.
Yeah, it was a totally different time. I swear there were 11 fighter bases in that region called the Eifel. And one of our best missions was just to take off and not have any airspace. And you would squawk, I think 033. You would come up on some TAD and talk to one of the German controllers. Yeah, this is Strawbasket. This is Sweet Apple. And you would just tell them, hey, I got two Eagles, an hour playtime. Let's run intercepts. And as long as you stayed below 10,000 feet and you ran on other military aircraft, knock yourself out. You know, one of the fun things to do was to go cap next to the entry point at Hahn Air Base. And everybody coming back into the pattern at Hahn gets tapped by two Eagles. And all you could do at LOAT was do a break turn, but it was still fun to sneak up on people and then, you know, make this whole four-ship of Vipers break. And you're like, nah. And then it was always the Germans who would fly low. There's all these noise complaints. You know, the Germans really didn't like us raging around, but it was the German Air Force that was raging around. And you'd be cruising along at 500 feet over someplace and you look down and there's a four-ship of F4s go underneath you. You're like, what the hell? Canadians also raged around. They were down on Sulligan. So that was the fun mission. It really was. And then when you would get to the big exercises, man, there was so much stuff flying around. You know, we had like the army was over there, helicopters, everything. It was also a navigational nightmare because you had all these control zones, specialized use airspace, things like that. So you would sit there. And all you would have would be your present position in your INS, and you'd pull that up, and then you'd have your thumb on a map, and you'd be like, oh, man, please don't let me fly through something. There was no situation display and all this kind of, you know, fancy stuff. It was clock to map. And I can remember being a wingman flying with one of these majors who was an A-10 pilot, and he had experience in Germany before flying the Eagle. I have no idea where we are. We're just raging around, and it's like things I haven't seen, and I swear there's factories all around us. And I'm like, where are we? And he goes, I know where I am. And because he's an A-10 guy, right?
He's
right,
down. Yeah, he's never looked up. He's just looking at the ground.
The other thing we did at Bitburg that was, I think, the most unique was sit alert. And so you had the 5-minute alert. They called it Zulu alert. And you had four jets on alert. And you would fly almost every workday. They'd call it a tango scramble. And so the horn would go off. You'd slide down the fireman pole. You'd run to the jet. And there were four bays. You lived in the center like in a firehouse. And in like a minute and a half, you would get the Eagle and you're in full burner screaming down the runway. You took off on runway 24 And then you would do the Immelmann departure to then go eastbound, because that's where your next threat was. So it was the Immelmann departures. And we would sit there in the flying squadron. The 2-2 is about halfway down the runways, and we would hear the burner takeoffs. And so we knew that that was the Zulus, and we'd watch out our windows. Because if they came by the window and you could see them with the gear up and they're smoking to get some airspeed, you knew that was going to be a good departure. They would get a good pull and get their smash. If you never saw them, they were above the window, you're like, man, they're not going to get the knock to be able to do the Immelmann pull. And it was always fun to be doing that, because in the Eagle ILF 100s, first you got to get them both to light. Sometimes you had to go, you know, backhand, back out. But then the next thing you know, you're doing this Immelmann pull and you go into the weather at 700 feet. You're like, oh, this is special, because now you're staring at your instruments and you'd have to roll out, get a rejoin, all that kind of stuff. But Bitburg Alert was too much fun. You sit around and you're wearing your G suit and you're waiting for the horn to go off, and it's a screaming loud klaxon.
Yeah. There's a lot there I want to talk about as a fighter pilot, because one, I've heard guys talk about the squawk and jumping other jets, and now having flown around Europe a good bit, I mean, it's like throw spaghetti at the wall and like hope you don't, you know, go into someone's airspace, etc. But then two, this Immelmann departure, I want people just to think about blasting, you know, doing an Immelmann, so going straight up and then turning on your back and then turning eastbound. But now you're finding your flight lead, or, you know, your wingman's back there, like, there's a lot that you could break down and to go into here. That's kind of sporty, especially in the day when you didn't have all these four flights and situations.
Yeah, so the standard for MQT, mission qualification training, was the day after you took your check ride, you went out to alert. And I can remember going out to alert and being practically nervous the whole time. You know, will I be able to run to my jet and be there? Because if you're number two, and when they go check 2, 3, 4, and you don't say 2, 3's got it. And so he's chomping at the bit to go, and 1 would kill you if you did that. And so the way it would roll is you'd get out there and you would take over the takeover alert, and you'd go put your gear up in the jet. And all of a sudden it becomes very precise as to where you put your helmet, what you're going to do, because, you know, you are literally on the ladder, and you reach in, sit down, and you pull the JFS, fire the APU, and then you keep going. Right. And there's this thing through here and that thing through here, and by the ladder moves and on, it becomes like a dance. And I can remember being very concerned about this kind of thing, that I was going to be able to do it. And finally, of course, you scramble. And as soon as you see number one, put it in burner, you're like, oh yeah, this is good stuff. I mean, and honestly, it wasn't a full, you know, air show demo at 180. It was like a 45 right up and moving around.
Right.
So we're out there on, I think it was Memorial Day, like an 88 or something like that. I'm with the weapons officer, and it's a beautiful summer day. But we know we're not going to fly because it's a U.S. federal holiday. And the headquarters calls up and goes, hey, you're taking a tour bus. Tour bus is coming out. Give them the tour. Tell them how great you are. And of course, the tour bus does not come into the building. It stops about 100 feet away from the building. So we go out there, Mush and I. He was my flight lead at the time. And all of these old guys pile off in the little funny hats, you know, the VFW hats. And it turns out these were guys who literally came ashore on D-Day and walked all the way to the Battle of the Bulge, and they're taking their tour. You know, they went into Normandy. They're taking the whole tour, and they just start telling stories. They just talk, and these were the guys who were in this little Luxembourg town called Echternach. And the Battle of the Bulge starts. They got run over. They got POWs. They were captured. And you know, the captain was like their company commander. He was like, I had to surrender. I mean, we were going to get it rolled. And the guys are like, that's okay, we understand. And these are old men, and you're just getting that greatest generation thing. And next thing you know, the horn goes off. I'm like, what the heck? Mush looks at me and pushes me out of the way. I hit the ground. He's in a full sprint back. And I'm like, well, if I go, I'm in a full sprint back. And so now we're running really fast to get back there, fired up. You run through the checker check and you come out of the barn. And again, it's an awesome feeling, because a minute ago you were talking to these guys, and these guys lined up on the do not cross line and then saluted Mush as he taxied by. You know, it was totally amazing. And so then we're flying around. It's Memorial Day. There's a few Germans to go intercept. There's nothing going on. And one of the American controls or groups are like, hey, why don't you do a flyby of our little place? And we're like, okay. I can't remember what it was. It was like Fan Belt. They all had cool little call signs. So So we rage to some part of Germany I had never been to. We go into fingertips, so I don't get to see anything. And he like does this diving pass to go over these guys. And he comes up and then they're like, well, did you see us? We were in the parking lot. And he's like, no. He goes, well, come by again. We'll get the commander's flag out and we'll be waving it at you. And so we come back around again and they're like, that's great. You guys did a good job. You know, it's just one of these fun days that you realize that this is actually it's a worthwhile business to do, you know.
Every now and then there's those really, that's pretty powerful too. I think just, yeah, seeing those guys out there, being able to talk to them and then klaxon going off and they're out there saluting you as you guys blast, which, man, what a different time, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, whatever. People would do horn checks. Because they always had, every day had to do a horn check. And so you'd have all the maintenance guys going, horn check, going to be a horn check. And the horn would come off. We'd all go cool. The classic was when the alert force commander would do a horn check and then go, oh, that was just a check, guys. Sorry. After you already started running, you know, I think we did that once. And all of a sudden, number four pulls a JFS and we're like, I guess we didn't get his attention. You know, it was a good
yeah. It's the devil's in the details. That communication piece sometimes will come out and bite you. That's different time. So, going from, yeah, I think that Soviet staring them down to the transition, you were a Desert Storm. Can you talk to me a little bit about how the dynamics of the transition from the Cold War mindset to what we are in today, but also talk a little Desert Storm and your experience there?
So Bitburg, each squadron had a lane. Each squadron had a place they had to go do their thing. And so you fought the war as a two ship. That's what you were going to go do. It's time to take off, go do your job. When you went to Iraq, all of a sudden we went back into the OCA and DCA mentalities. You know, you would form up with a bunch of Vipers and the Weasel guys, and you'd push north and you'd do what you learned to do out of Red Flags. And that, what to me was the biggest change as far as that. You also really started doing the air supremacy, air dominance thing. I mean, the Iraqis didn't fly after day three. They started burying their airplanes kind of deal. So after that, I'm just going to rage around your country and go wherever I want and do whatever I want. A very different concept of, you know, instead of being totally defensive, you're like, dude, I'm going to bring it. And I can. And, you know, now in today's war, you know, adversaries may fly against us more than likely. And adversaries have very, very complex SAM systems. So it becomes more and more difficult. But that's what you got, you know, Raptors, F-35s, the whole modern Air Force is for. But we, you know, the first thing was just getting there. Right. So we used to have a commitment to deploy, like, I don't know, eight jets and get somewhere really quickly out of Langley. And so we roll in there in the morning, and the squadron commander, you know, says, all right, you guys are all on alert, go home. And it was only like 10 of us. And then nothing happened. And we started like, hey, are we going to Iraq? What's going on? And, you know, we had no cell phones. We had home phones. You know, a couple of the guys had pagers, you know. Eventually they call us back in and we're like, this is it. We're going in. Bring your bags. You know, you get your bags packed. And they're like, hey, we're just going to fly the jets. It's been like two or three days. Maintenance has generated them. Let's go fly. So we went into the intercepts with three bags and 4x4. And it was weird flying with that kind of configuration because you never flew with three bags, you know, unless you're going somewhere. Yeah, it's just a very heavyweight airplane. So then we come back. We go a couple more days. And then all of a sudden it's like, come to work. And you show up and the whole squadron's going. And not only the whole squadron's going, but like lieutenants are piling into back seats. We're taking everything. And the next day, the other squadron's going. And so that was impressive. And, you know, you get a call. I swear I got a call like at 10 o'clock in the morning. And by 11:30, airborne rejoining on a KC-10 in a cell of six. And we're going to fly for 15 hours. We're let's go. You know, fortunately, we weren't wearing poopy suits. And next thing you know, we land. We go into this big briefing room with this Saudi general who talks about defending.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The border, and if it flies, it dies kind of stuff. And we're like looking at each other. And the next thing you know, the guys who came over who had pilot rest, because they came over on the 141s, they're airborne. And we manned that darn cap for months. sitting there, you know, just south of the border, listening to the whole thing, and then watching everybody else show up, you know, watching the 82nd Airborne show up, watch all the tanks show up, all that stuff. And then the war kicked off. So it was an interesting transition. Just made you really think.
Yeah. What, I mean, a different world. And you mentioned something that I found curious, because the episode I did with Admiral Fox, he was talking about that mindset shift that I really hadn't thought about, where, you know, I remember I was a little kid at the time, but yes, Saddam had the second, third biggest army in the world, right? It's going to be a fight. Yes. Yep. And he said, the initial mentality was kind of a defensive posture. And I think a lot of that probably comes from Cold War, et cetera, to this kind of, he said, it was like a switch that happened at some point where, oh no, like we're offensive, or we're going to take the fight to them. This is kind of a mentality shift. Somewhat interesting to me.
So it is generational, right? So, you know, years later, I'm at the War College and I decide that I'm going to do a paper on Robin Olds. What else would you do? So I'm digging around in the archives and I pull up the audio tape from like Blue 16 on, it's a cassette of Operation Bolo. Let's go kill 7 MiGs in one sortie. And it was just fascinating to try to understand it, to listen to a little bit of comm discipline, to hear their voices and to see how they do it. And then suddenly realize, hey, wait a minute, that's what we do. And next thing you know, you pull out this map of North Vietnam and you overlay it over the Nellis Ranges and go, hey, check it out. It's like exactly the same size. And so this whole thing about getting on a tanker and doing the route pack thing, going north, doing all that kind of stuff, it's in our DNA. It's what we did. We just kind of forgot about it, I think, until all of a sudden you're in a Desert Storm and yeah, that's what we do. Like I remember they talked about in Vietnam how the tankers were heroes. They would actually come north and grab F-4s and, you know, Pardo's push, stuff like that. I can remember being on day 3 with the KC-10 at sunrise going over the tri-border area because we had changed things. He wasn't going to cap south of the border. We needed more gas. Let's go. And so I'm with the weapons officer. We pull up on this bright white and blue KC-10 just at dawn, and he's got all his lights on. It's like, dude, we're in the tanker track, and we pull up the 4th ship, and we are driving way north. And the lead goes, hey, you know we are in Iraq. You might want to like change your light setting. Guy goes completely off. Everything's gone. Like, hey. Maybe the strip lights, dude. Give me the strip lights here. And I can remember another day coming up on a 135 to get my gas. I look up at him, and there are 3 faces looking back at me out the window, 2 spotters and 1 boomer. And they're all, you can see the buckles on their parachutes. And I'm like, oh yeah, we are way north of the border. But we did that in Vietnam. So the American Air Force is very impressive, I think. It really is. And even today, I think it would blow me away if I really got back connected up again with it.
Yeah. And I think you probably can draw a parallel or analogy to what the Air Force is, I think, doing today. Whereas we've spent the last 20 years in an uncontested air environment and now pivoting towards our near peer threat. It's going to be a much different fight if that fight mm-hmm. should happen. So again, it's just kind of like knocking off the dust on the books. Like, all right, hey, we've done counterinsurgency and close air support for the last 20 years, but there's other skill sets that are probably going to be more at the forefront of the next fight, if you will. So interesting. It does. And ebbs and flows, you know, cycle. Your time, so after Desert Storm, you're at Langley, you can go to weapons school in that time period. Can you talk a little bit about weapons school, what it was like back in the day?
You know, weapons school, it's a trip. They used to call it a trip to no slack island, right? There's no slack here. You'd walk in the squadron. It was the barnyard is what they called it because of the way it looked, like a bunch of stalls. It was little desks, little walls around them. And the first thing you see is on the chalkboard, the number to the Betty Ford Clinic, in case you got problems. And the next number you see is the number to the Greyhound bus line, in case you need to get a ride out of here. So it was really fierce sarcasm and ridicule. And it was a very tough course. At the time, there weren't that, you know, it was the Eagle, the Viper A-10, and Intel, I think, and maybe the ABMers. It wasn't the much larger, much different school. But I remember being very intimidated and very impressed. Like, don't don't make eye contact, don't get to be targeted. We were in the first class that was going to be part of the two class a year cycle. So we had a lot of students, and so that kind of helped us out. You know, before it was classes of 3 and 4. Now we were a class of 8, and so we had WASA. We thought we were somebody.
Was a course shorter with 3 or 4?
Yeah. They increased it because they wanted to do more and more integration. That's why we're in the 6 month model now. This was a long time ago, but you know, it's funny how you remember back at it. Like, well, there were a lot of majors that were instructors. Old crusty majors. Ooh, those guys were probably 33, really experienced. Yeah, and I loved every one of them, and I feared them at the same time. You know, the BFM for an Eagle driver is the rite of passage. You got to get past BFM. You're not just going to pass BFM and move on. And so, of course, I hit my Waterloo at offensive BFM. Not, I don't even make it to defensive BFM before. Hey, this isn't going well. And my problem was I was very aggressive. I wanted to kill the guy now. And it's very bad to be that way because you fly a tight wire, everything's cool, you kill him quickly. But if he's any good, you're neutralized. Life's not good. So I'm flying with Tex Merrill, and he was he had a star, man. He was extremely experienced pilot. And he says to me in the debrief, is this a fair assessment of your performance? And I'm like, I guess, yeah. Well, you bust. Well, it turns out that is his standard line. Everybody knew it, and they hadn't told me that if he says, is this a fair assessment of your performance? You're going down. You just hang your head. So sure enough, now after flying with that ride, you get to fly with the squadron commander. All right, let's make it even more stressing. Let's make it even more difficult. And that's just the mindset of the weapons school. You know, the things don't get easier if you have trouble. We'll give you all the attention you need, but you better step up and perform. So I pass, you know, my rides and I move on. I get to the LOAT ride, which is for an Eagle guy, it's just LOAT. It's not like, you know, flying like a striker and doing stuff like that. Only reason we do it is because we got to go kill the striker. So we do LOAT. 300-foot ride. It's a bunch of exercises. It's a bunch of stuff. And I'm flying with Tex Merrill again. And we get in the debrief. And he looks at me and he goes, is that a fair assessment of your performance? And I do the, oh, my gosh. Oh, my God.
I know.
I'm busting the dumbest ride. And he goes, no, wait. I mean, do you understand? And I went, And he starts smiling. And I'm like, hey, I read your book, Rommel. I know what this is going on. So that was, you know, that's how I would describe that time frame. And I flew with excellent guys. And when I was invited back to become an instructor, I enjoyed it all the more because you really get into that. The weapons school is a see one, do one kind of a thing. So we're going to go do TI, dude. You know, I'm going to be Rambo one. I'm going to show you how it's done and make everything perfect all the way to the deeper, even controlling the adversaries, making sure that they are, you know, doing the right things. And then you fly as Rambo two and you keep teaching as you watch the students do it. And, you know, I flew with guys that to this day, I still appreciate the heck out of, you know what I mean? Like I can remember my next generation, my commander, when I flew the Raptor, Magoo Walters, he was a leaving instructor. He was about done. I was like one of his last rides and he knew me from Bitburg. So we go up and fly high aspect BFM and I am just hanging on soaked in sweat. And he is just like, whatever, this is easy, you know, but his lesson to me was, let's talk about students. Let's talk about taking care of them and making sure that you train. I don't care about your briefing was 2 minutes long. You'll get that right, Biff. But I just really appreciated his approach and his essay and the fact that he was just killing me without even thinking about it. It was like, my gosh, this guy's a monster. And yet, give me 3 years at the same position, I could get to barely that level as well. So weapons school was fun. Weapons school was real good.
Yeah, and for those listening that aren't super familiar with weapons school, I think, you know, again, the analogy there is Top Gun for the Air Force. But, you know, my buddies who have been through weapons school, it's super impressive to see what it goes through doing weapons school support and just get a little, like, look at just the excruciating pain that these guys are going through, guys and gals are going through to earn that patch is super impressive. And then to see the product on the flip side, you're like, they're phenomenal instructors, usually. Maybe there's like one that's still cheap, but like there's some betting that goes through.
It's interesting how the weapons school and Top Gun things came about. You would like to give everybody the same training. Everybody gets to shoot a missile. Everybody gets a million gun rides. Everything's great, but you can't. you just don't have the resources to do it. And the idea that you will, you'll take one guy, give him as everything you can do possibly in the aircraft. And then his job is not to become this arrogant dude. His job is to give it to everybody else. It's an amazing concept. And that's why they talk weapons officers, the first hallmark is humility. Because you do the, dude, I am a rock star. I have done everything possible in my aircraft. But that's not going to enable you then to give it to somebody else. And that, that a lot of the lessons that, that they would talk about, especially towards the graduation time frame, is, you know, you're busy doing stuff. How do you, you know, quit doing stuff and take care of that second lieutenant that's just got a dumb question? But to him, it's super important.
Right.
You know, and I, hats off to a lot of the people that, you know, years ago came up with this concept of do everything for one guy. It's all you can afford. And then he shares it with everybody else. Like I can remember doing that. We were at Langley and we come back from the war and I realized that, you know, our missions were like 10 hours. That was our standard day. And so mostly what you do in flying around the flagpole is go do a 1.0 ASD, go out to the water, fly, come back. So I was able to work with the commander and the ops officer and come up with long range employment. And so we would take off on a Langley, hit actually a tanker would come into Langley first, a KC-10, load up our maintainers, and we'd take off with 10 Eagles. And that tanker would haul us all the way out to 2508, all the way out to Edwards. And we met up with the Miramar guys. The Marine Guard guys, Marine Reserves, I think, fight a big mission, land there, and then employ out of their base for the weekend, and then fly back home with the tanker. So, you know, it's just what you're able to do because you've seen it either in combat or at weapons school to go, oh yeah, this is kind of important.
Yeah, and I know it's for weapons officers worried, you know, in the squadron. And whatever that mission doc statement, you know, requires, they're handling that. If it's, you know, hey, there's some conflict on the horizon, they're prepping or they're doing instructor pilot upgrade rides, which were very intensive. If I remember being, you know, a young wingman and asking Poker or Hyde or Nelson, who was our Dutch exchange officer, who was a patch, those guys, you know, they would stop what they're doing. And maybe it was a really dumb question. They could let go look up here, you know, and they come back to me. Or, hey, let's sit down and we're going to talk for 15, 30 minutes, whatever it might be, to explain this concept, which I don't have time to do, but I'm going to take the time and do it.
Because that's the mentality. There was a guy in Bitburg, Zane Lowry. Unfortunately, he died in an aircraft accident. It was very tragic. But I knew him when he was not a weapons officer. But you know, I think he went to weapons school, came back, and I knew him. But literally, he would get into a briefing, and he could give you the Encyclopedia Britannica of what you're going to go do, and he could see exactly what you did wrong, and he didn't care. He was just gonna teach you. And one of the things that we got to do, since we had D models, was to go ride in the back seat. And that was the classic line, you know, the wingman, don't ride with him, but ride with the IP, because you get a log time, and then see what he does. And I can remember flying with Zane and just listening to his comments. You know, we're both looking over our shoulder at this guy, and he would say something like, "Oh, he's too wide" or whatever, and you're like, "Oh, is that what it looks like?" It was just that extra moment of getting that essay. And I always appreciated that.
Yeah. Can you talk to me a little bit about, I guess, the humility piece? Because humble, approachable, credible. That's a macho weapon.
That's it.
And, you know, the Viper, the 16th, I don't know if it's still there, but I remember seeing it. They had the Dos Equis sign, the triple X. So they would light up the X's because someone was always on 2X ride. But yeah. And this goes from pilot training. And then just ramps up throughout, you know, the B course to weapon school. But yeah, if you bust a ride in pilot training, depending on where it is in the phase, it might trigger a ride with the DO or the commander. Or it might probably start with the flight commander. And as you bust that ride, then it's going to trigger one with the DO or commander. But then later on, like if you burn that early, like it's automatically like you bust one ride into phase. Now it's right to an 89 ride, as we call it. Ride with the commander. And then, you know, if you bust that, you're out the door. So, and then they go into the B course, same guy who is on an X ride and then a double X ride. Like the stress and the pressure just increases. But it seems like weapon school, maybe just like someone's always on a double X ride. That stress and strain if I screw up tomorrow, I'm out the door. Can you talk to me a little bit about that, how that works?
So, you know, all pilots have to figure out their stress as they approach check rides or, you know, do whatever. And they got to figure it out. It's just part of the course. What I remember back to is seeing that that 1-800 Greyhound bus line phone number on the wall was a way of getting you kind of numb to it. You know what I mean? I mean, like, dude, you are two rides away from going home any day. We could, you, that's it. It is possible. And I found that at weapons school, it became perfect for me because I was always a high stress kind of a young pilot. But at weapons school, I suddenly realized that every ride is a check ride. Every ride demands that kind of stress. And slowly, it didn't bother me. You know, hey, you're gonna go fly the commander. Yep, yes, I do. You know, it doesn't bother me. And it just little bits and pieces of my career would do that for me, right? So like, you know, that weird time frame when you're a very high hour wingman and you want to become a flight lead, you think you're perfect and all that kind of stuff, and you're ready to go. I'm taxiing back in Incirlik, and the radios aren't working. It's hot. I'm annoyed. I can't believe this. I take my helmet off. I can't stand listening to the babble anymore. And I take my helmet off as I come down the final parking ramp, turn the 90, boom, park in my slot. I'm going to be shutting down in a second. I got ear foamies in. I'm just frustrated. And so I'm sitting there, my helmet's hanging there by the HUD, and I casually look over to the Eagle next to me. Excellent. It's the wing commander. So now what do I do? Do I quickly throw my helmet back on? Do I leave it off? Do I quickly wave to my crew chief? Shut down, shut down, shut down. I mean, if you put the helmet back on, you're a loser. And it's like, I don't know what to do. So I sit there, shut down. Man, now I'm stressing. You know, grab my 781s, go back inside. By the time I hit the ops desk, the wing commander has perfectly timed his radio call to call in and go, hey, get me, this is Eagle One. Get me Stinger One, my squadron commander. So now I'm like, ah. I still got like my stuff on. I'm trying to find my squadron commander before he can answer that radio call to tell him, dude, it was me. I had no helmet. I swear I had a hot spot, blah, blah. And of course the squadron commander looks at me and he's like, you're an idiot. But sure enough, he gets on the radio and he's all humble pie. You know, this is Eagle One. I want to know why Lieutenant Moth thinks he can taxi my Eagle without a helmet and blah, 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 blah. And I'm just melting there. Everyone at the ops desk is like, ooh, don't make eye contact with him. Squadron commander is just doing the, oh, yes, sir, three bags full, sir, yes, sir, we'll take care of that, sir. Oh, goodness gracious. And Fang is the commander, takes me in a room, does his business, you know, lectures me or whatever, and says, you know, we shall speak no more of this. Next day, what does Fang do? He puts me as the wingman to the wing commander. Okay. Here we are. So now I show up at this thing, you know, and I give him the weather and the NOTAMs or whatever, and he looks at me and he's like, well, that's all good there, Biff, but you think you can keep your helmet on today? Yes, sir. My helmet's going to be on, chin strap. You got it, man. I mean, it was crack up. So now I'm flying on its wing. We're en route. I think I do the battle damage check, and I'm expecting him to give me the push. Go out to spread. We'll fly back in Incirlik. He doesn't. He leaves me a fingertip. You know, whatever. You're just a dumb lieutenant. He proceeds to drop his mask and smoke a cigarette. And I'm like, what the hell? You're giving me crap. It was so much fun. I loved the hell out of him. He was an old F4 guy. And I'm just sitting there looking at him, and he's just smoking a cigarette. And so what we do? And I'm like, point taken, sir. I will not do this again. So maybe, I don't know. Maybe that's a little bit of the humility, but also a lot about the community, about it's, you play hard. It's very serious.
That's awesome. One a different time, but it still translates to today, and you just kind of get.
I think so.
Yeah, you get
it. I think so. We're still people, right? We're still people doing these things.
Absolutely. So, weapons school, and then you're back to Langley as a weapons officer, or what was?
Yeah, I went back to Langley for another year and a half, and I went back to weapons school as an instructor.
Okay.
Did that for 3 years. Super good time, and then back to the staff. And then I'm like, all right, let's get it. Let's go be an ops officer. It's that age, Lieutenant Colonel Mott. And I'm up in Alaska talking to the OG like, hey, I'd really like to come here. Alaska would be a great place to fly. I used to be an Alaskan. Well, you know, I got nothing for you, Mott. I got nothing. There's nothing here. Not going to happen. I go back to my queue, my hotel. My phone rings. It's the commander at weapons school. Hey, Biff, what are you doing? No, I thought I was coming to Alaska, but I guess not. He's like, well, why don't you come back out to Nellis? And I'm like, nah. You only do one tour. He goes, oh, no, you come back. You come back to be the ops officer. It'll be good for you. I'm like, okay. You never turn things down. I call the wife up and go, hey, we're going back to Vegas. She's like, no, we're not going back to Vegas. No way. We did that. And I said, well, sorry. So she hangs up. She's not happy. And we go out and have the greatest assignment. You know, I quickly became the commander out there. And I flew with guys that would go on to fly the Raptor in the DT and the OT. It was a different, this was 2001, 2003. So it's not that 90s vibe anymore. It's a very totally different vibe in 2000. General Rand was the commandant and the school was much bigger. So I had a great time being the commander out there for that.
Because the Raptor is coming online in that time period, right? So it's sort of developed tactics. Is that part of it?
They didn't need lieutenant colonels at the time. They needed captains and majors to figure out what to do with it. And so, you know, I think there were like 8 guys. Corky was one of them. Fumez was another one of them. They go out. They are figuring out what to do in the Raptor. You know, this is the phase when the test pilots have done it all and they've said, it's good. Now let's go figure out how you're going to employ it. And so you go out there and do that developmental test to operational test. And then while I went to the staff, they opened up Tyndall and started bringing the jets in there. And when I finished up my next staff tour, I got a chance to go back to Tyndall. There you go. And now it's my turn to get into the Raptor a little bit late, but it was super fun.
That's funny. And, you know, Fumez, when he was the A3, the 2-star there, I was able to twist his arm to get in the back seat of the Viper to do the demo with me. So that was fun.
That's right. You were a demo pilot. I remember seeing your videos. Yeah. You know?
So I was able to twist. I always liked getting the bosses in the back, in the pit, you know, to get a little exposure to what the demo was. He was kind enough. He was a great boss. Yeah, you know, boss, but, you know. Get a little Viper demo appreciation.
We had the Eagle demo at Eglin when I was there, and I got to be the safety observer for that. I thought it was awesome just to watch the whole thing. I really liked the Raptor demo because the Raptor demo maneuvers, you go out on an AHC ride and you're doing the pedal turn. You're like, yeah. And so it just kind of dawned on me. It wasn't like a heroic effort to go fly the Eagle demo and just be, you know, crazy. The Raptor demo, it's like, yeah, I'm a pilot. I can do that. It just had a different ring for me. And I still like watching the Raptor demo.
I think if anyone doesn't like watching the Raptor demo, they can just get out. Because I mean, yeah, exactly. It is impressive to see what that plane can do. And then fighting it, you know, when you're trying your best there. And there's some ways, but usually you're just getting your butt kicked. And that thing, it's doing what it's meant to do. It's just impressive. So. Yeah, you know, I want transpectoring. I want all these things, all the magic that goes along with it. But the Raptor's impressive. Watch that demo. The time there. So we talked a little bit about Tyndall, but you're coming out of staff, get hired to be the group commander at Tyndall. Yeah. Is that how it works?
Yeah.
Can you talk to me a little bit about what that time period too was like, and specifically like bringing the B course online? What were some of the challenges you guys faced down there as you're really trying to stand that up?
I got to give you 2 answers. One of those is that you as a person face challenges, right? Because you're not the 27-year-old captain who just graduated weapons school. You're now this gray-haired colonel who's going to show up. How do you fit your role? How do you still be the commander and fly well and deal with that? And I had very good commanders throughout all my experience that really hit the mode of, hey, if I can't be number one, I'm not going to be a good commander. So I kind of followed into that mode, is that I wanted to focus in on every ride and everything. Like there was a time when you would have a commander who's not a flight lead. He's a wingman. And you're like, why are you a wingman? Well, I'm really busy being a commander. Like, no. That's not my way of looking at it. So I had that problem going into the Raptor, and I was very conscientious of it because it's totally new. It is not an Eagle, and I'm a little bit older. So let's not be a buffoon here. You don't want to be that guy. So that's one challenge that I had. The beauty of it is that one of my weapons school IPs, General Walters, had already gone through all that. And so he already had the ideas to tell me about how not to be that guy. And literally we were competing back and forth as to who could fly the best Raptor. It was fun. The other big challenge about the Raptor was it's not an Eagle, but I'm an Eagle driver. Therefore, I'm going to employ it like an Eagle. There are certain things that we do. And it took the Viper guys to get into it and the Strike Eagle guys to get into it and going, what are you doing? We don't have to do it this way. And that debate between the communities, I think, made it stronger. I think it would be fun to go back now and see what a Raptor briefing, debriefing is like, because I'll bet it's a it's a stronger hybrid from what it used to be. And so that was the big debate amongst the people about how are we going to create this Raptor identity? You know what I mean? You know, I can remember the young guy asking me, so are you an Eagle driver or a Raptor driver? And I'm like, well, yes. You know, like, no. Which one are you, man? But that was the biggest challenge there. The other one, if you remember, that was the start of the FA-22. Remember that? Let's be bomb droppers. So great capability, something that I knew what the B word was. But
yeah, never said that as an Eagle driver. Yeah, that's a foreign word. So I remember
one of my trips out there as a I don't know what I was doing, but I was at Luke and I got to go fly with the 62nd. And I'm in the back seat of this guy and we're loaded for bear. I swear we had rockets, bombs, and gun or whatever, and it was all live. And we were raging around somewhere in the Goldwater Range with a wingman. And the IP was the TAC-P. And so, or the ALO, whatever. He would drop his mask and all of a sudden start saying, okay, we're going to kill the third building and look out for Jimmy, who's a truck over there. And he played this whole game up and I was just eating it up. And we're doing like low-level run-ins, pop up, acquire the building, shoot a rocket. And, you know, it was totally, totally fascinating. I had never seen this kind of thing. I don't know what it was called, CAS or service attack or whatever. So now I'm in the Raptor and we're dropping bombs. And it's fake bombs, but we're dropping bombs. And so I go, you know, I saw this once. I'm going to play FAC or whatever. So I'm out there with one of the B-coursers and I'm dropping my mask and going, all right, we're going to roll in here and run this and blah, 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 blah. And we do all our stuff because, you know, part of the fun is the loading in coordinates, right? You can pre-plan or you can do it on the fly. So I'm doing the whole thing, authenticate, blah, blah, blah. So we do this whole ride and I thought it went pretty well, you know, cool. And I don't tell anybody. And the kid gets up Friday night in the bar and goes, hey, I flew with Colonel Mott and he was working with this ALO that he found from an old friend who was on the ground in Apalachicola. And he called in all these strikes on us and we're having to reprogram and do this kind of stuff. People are looking at me and I'm like, all right, honestly, I was lying the whole time. And people just bust out laughing. The Viper guys are like, no way. Where'd you learn to do that? I saw it once. I thought it was a good idea. I don't think that became a standard in the Raptor community, but I had fun with it. It was an interesting story.
And for those listening, if you didn't pick up on it, you know, in the Eagle community, saying the word bomb is against every grain of being in that community because you don't drop bombs in the sea bottle. But I think now it's like, yeah, OIR, we had Raptors over there who were initially doing, you know, air-to-air maintenance, but then they started dropping bombs. So now they can say the word bomb. And then also to piggyback on that, it's impressive to see there's some guys who deserve Oscars for their acting as a forward air controller, you know, as some, you know, they can simulate whatever type nationality.
That's right. British accent, yeah. Australian accent.
Oh, yeah. Whatever you need them to be. And they're just pretending to be that person on the ground, you know, helping their student drop bombs or whatever it might be. So, again, there's some guys I think that's probably where they spend the vast majority of their time.
I honestly thought that was a very, very professional sortie that I saw out at Luke because, you know, we basically said we're going to go to this area and we don't know what we're going to do. That was like the briefing, you know, and we had three different kinds. I'm pretty sure we rocketed, strafed, and dropped BDUs, and it was very busy. We had two bags on it, so we were out there for a long time. Very intense. All the deliveries were like, okay, you just called this kind of target, therefore it's going to be this kind of pass. It was extremely, like being A-10 pilot. I mean, like this would have been real cool to do. But yeah, nowadays with Raptors, F-35s, what they can bring to get the weapons there is pretty impressive.
Yeah, for sure. I did like close air support sorties because when the commission are dynamic and you are switching between weapons and you're figuring out, you know, what type of weapon you need to drop and delays, et cetera, and, you know, working with the JTAC because it ties to, like, I think also doing seed or DCA, like DCA and having to build that air picture in your mind in the Viper because you don't have the magical radar there, but you're building that and then, you know, working your tactics from that point. It's very dynamic and it requires, for me, a lot of brain bites to be utilized to try and do it, which is, I think, is kind of fun to do. So, yeah, different world to say the least. But that's funny, too. You also mentioned the Raptor. So, here I got a Raptor Eagle driver here. Is it chalk or is it a whiteboard? Which one? What is
it? Okay. I'm a chalk guy all the way through. And unfortunately, chalk is dead, right? They killed it. But there was nothing better than having chalk in your hand and you're debriefing and you're sweating and you wipe your hand and all of a sudden you got chalk on your face. You got war paint. I can remember helping one of my WUG buddies, and we're doing one of the TI rides, and I swear there's like, you know, 12 different people. And being a smart, helpful guy, I gave him 12 pieces of chalk. You know, we aren't going to do this. We aren't going to do the solid line, dash line, and pink. We're going to, dude, you got 12 pieces of chalk. I'm helping you out. And he just looks at me like, what the hell? But it's Trivial Pursuit. It really is. You know, people would argue that, well, if you use pens, you'll leave the cap off and they'll dry out and therefore it just won't be good enough. And you're like, oh, whatever, dude. You know, I mean, nowadays things are probably all recorded anyway. You know, like you're in a simulator and it's all right there. But there's an old article from General Gorenz now, how to draw like a Gomer. I mean, it's artwork to make these things, especially if you're doing the hoofer doofers through the vertical. But yeah, chalk was the way to go. And that just drove people crazy too. That was so old school.
That's what I mean. I walked into the Raptor Vault. I'm like, there's a chalkboard, there's a whiteboard. You know, I mean, I guess we're just appeasing both parties here to make sure everyone's happy. But sir, before we wrap up here, I always like to ask my guests, you know, if you found 15, 16 year old Biff walking down the street, is there any advice you would give him? Any tips, tricks, point outs, things to do different? Just a softball.
You know, I would go back and I would say, have more confidence in yourself. I mean, I really did. I remember those days of freaking out over check rides and worried about what's next and am I going to fly, you know, a Cessna instead of an Eagle. But it's interesting to see how with experience, I got more confident and I didn't have that stress. The problem with a young guy and being confident is you become cocky. And so that doesn't work. But there is a right way to have confidence in yourself as a young man. And trust in what you know and work hard at it. And I think things work out pretty well.
Awesome. Sir, thanks for joining me on the podcast. It was fun to chat with you.
I enjoyed it. Thank you so much. This has been great, Ray. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, so you got a few minutes just to There I Was story?
Yes, I've been thinking about it since you got that Viper on the picture back there. I can remember Desert Storm was all about air refueling, right? Because you'd had three bags, but you'd go up and then you're flying 10-hour sorties. I can remember being on the wing of a KC-10 with my wingman, middle of the day. We're back over the tri-border area or whatever. And I'm taking gas. And you're to the point at that point where you had director lights, but you also had a mirror. And you just sit there and stare at the mirror because you could see the apple and it's how you did it. And my wingman zipper clicks the radio. And I'm like, what? I'm in the green. I look over at him and he goes, and I go, okay. I look over the other shoulder and there's a Hill Viper, yellowtail. I think it's the Fujins. He's got nothing on that airplane except two AIM-9s. He's got all his racks are empty. And I'm like, okay. And he points at the boom and I'm like, got it. Pop off, back away, kind of fly formation down there and route with him. And he comes in and just about the time he hooks up, I pick up his wingman joining. He's got nothing either. Maybe he's got an ECM pod on the center line or whatever. And I swear this guy just takes a sip. He's like, ooh, little gas. Boop. Salutes, drops out of the way. Wingman comes in, does the same thing. Boop. And they leave. And I'm like, all right, I contributed to the war today. I saved somebody because I swear the guy's bombing the Republican guards and probably looked up and went, I need that. And just got up there and got his gas. It was a great story.
That's wild. Again, what a different Jerry. I mean, obviously, you never found out what those guys were doing, but being where they were and what they look like, you know, there's only a couple things they couldn't have done. That's wild.
No, that was just fun stuff.
Yeah. Well, sir, I appreciate you sharing. Thanks for joining me on the podcast. It was fun to have you on here and just talk a little bit.
You too, Rain. You got a very good podcast. It brings up a lot of ideas. I mean, now I'm all pumped up and ready to go work on simulators. And
that's awesome.
You know, little bit of nostalgia is really, really good. And I'll mention this to a couple of the guys that I respect who I think would be really good for you to talk to. Like Mike Hostage would be good because he was there in the war with us. General Looney for sure, because he's a total like commander leader kind of guy, just real intense kind of guy. And it'd be good.
Yeah,
it'd be therapy for them, right?
Well, it's fun. Again, I mean, capturing these stories and sharing them because there are a lot of people, again, who they really enjoy hearing about these stories that, you know, for you, it's admin. It's going to the airspace, something you don't even talk about, right? Unless something went wrong. And, just things that I guess we take for granted that most people are like, what? I have no idea.
I don't think you have a problem finding people talk about their flying experiences because, geez, even now I'm like, oh, you forgot that story. Oh, dude, you should have told him about such and such because, you know.
We can do it again. If you got another story you want to share, I mean, yeah, more the merrier.
Honestly, give me a little bit of time and I can talk to you about flying with my Navy buddy Spock, who was just hilarious. He's a Hornet driver in an Eagle going, man, I can't make the switches work. I'll just use the gun. You're like, oh, dude, we're doing ACM. Can you please kill this guy?
kill him now. I'm so tired.
You know, and I had the Thunderbirds come into my base for the air shows. Talk about that. I can think of a couple more.
Yeah, that'd be great. So great. Sir, I really enjoyed it. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, man. I'm gonna get back to work.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye.
The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns, Gear, and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
Good news, bad news. All those spam and text calls you've been getting lately? Well, that's a result of your information having been sold by third-party data brokerages, or it's been stolen and sold to nefarious people. Ticketmaster recently had a data breach where 560 million users' information was stolen and sold in the dark web. This included their names, physical addresses, email addresses, credit card information, and much more. Best case scenario, this just ends with more annoying phone calls and text messages. Worst case, it's going to end in fraud and you're really going to be in the hurt locker. That's why I've been using a service called Aurora for over a year now. I've talked about it on the podcast before, but not only do they monitor the dark web and the internet for my information in case it is involved in a breach, they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. When I signed up, they identified over 60 that had my information and went right to work removing me from these data brokerages. Now, yep, you could do this yourself, but each one of these data brokerages has its own policies and procedures, and I have no idea how you would even start trying to remove yourself from these services, let alone how much time that would take. But Aurora does that, as well as they offer a whole suite of tools to keep you safe, including a VPN, antivirus, password management, parental controls, and identity theft insurance. You get this all in one app, one place, so it's super simple. And you can do this with a 14-day risk-free trial. Super simple. And if you don't like it, you just cancel anytime. It's not complicated. At a minimum, you can take a look and see what information of yours is out there lurking on the web right now. Use the link down below in the description or go to aurora.com/afterburn and you get 14 days risk-free, cancel anytime, super easy, and take the first step in protecting yourself out there on the interwebs. That's the good news, by the way.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.